Hey everybody, it's Pastor Brian Ross from Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We want to welcome you to this video. Appreciate you tuning in and watching our channel here, Grace Life Bible on YouTube. If you haven't already done so, if you consider subscribing and ringing the alarm bell as a way of staying current with the ministry. We go live from the Assembly Building on Sunday mornings, as well as when we create content for you here midweek. We would certainly appreciate that. Also want to remind you about our Rumble channel here. We established this as an alt-text site. Should something happen to our YouTube channel. So if you're into alt-text sites or would like an alternative to YouTube, please consider subscribing and checking us out here on Rumble as well. My featured book in this video, again, is my newest release, From This Generation Forever, A Study of God's Promise to Preserve His Word, Volume 2. And this is dedicated to setting forth a doctrine of preservation. And this is about a 380-page book covering issues related to the preservation of Scripture. In this book, I set forth my views regarding verbatim identicality, substantive doctrinal equivalence, and some of the subjects that we have been sort of talking about in this series of videos that we're working on here. My purpose in making this video is, again, to respond to this video by brothers Mark Ward and Timothy Berg, evaluating some of the work of King James Version defender Brian Ross. This video came out in July. It was released on July 20, and I have been slowly trying to fit into my schedule a response to this video that I thought was thorough and complete, at least as theoretically possible, given the constraints of time, etc. And so this is the fourth video in my response. If you have not watched parts 1, 2, and 3, I strongly encourage you to stop watching this video right now and go and watch parts 1, 2, and 3 first, because each part is building on the previous as we work our way through this content. And as I've done in the first three videos, I would just like to read from Colossians 4:6 at the beginning. I am endeavoring to try to answer this video by brothers Ward and Berg in the spirit of Colossians 4:6. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man. So I'm trying to give a gracious yet thorough response to what's been said here. And so this is my fourth attempt to do that. Now, jumping right into the content then in this video, in the third video, the previous one to this one, I went through the section, the last third of this video, where they were talking about my views on verbatim identicality of wording. They talked about the Zoom level that one should have as far as, you know, at what level of Zoom do variants matter. And we went through an analysis of that in that video. Recall, though, that they say, particularly Brother Berg says, that variants change the meaning of a particular text. So they do acknowledge and grant the fact that textual variants do change the knowledge of a particular text. And what I said is sort of like a micro level, but at a macro level, they say that no doctrine of the Bible is affected by these variants that do change the meaning of a particular text. Okay. So I went through an analysis of that in the last video. Here, I just would like to say, like, so I'm not sure how that works if the scripture, if Bible doctrine is established by Bible verses. And we are told in the Bible that, you know, think that we should read, you know, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. The way God teaches is he scatters doctrine across scripture, and the Bible student, the Bible believer, is then charged to rightly divide the word of truth, to study the scriptures. No prophecy of scripture is any private interpretation. 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about how we're to compare spiritual things with spiritual things. So if Bible doctrine is built on Bible verses, I don't understand the argument then that you can change that a variant can change the meaning of a particular verse, but not the sort of macro understanding of what the Bible teaches. That does not make sense to me, and I address that in my third response. Okay, now in this video, I want to zero in as they're talking about verbatim identicality, as they're talking about the Zoom level and whether verbatim identicality is legitimate principle and you know where the Zoom should go, etc. Brother Ward brings up his paper that he wrote for the Detroit Baptist Seminary Journal in 2020, Which Texas Receptus, a Critique of Confessional Bibliology. So Brother Ward brings this up in context in this video related to my principle of verbatim identicality and the level of Zoom. Now, he mentions the paper at the 1 hour, basically the 1 hour mark, and then he mentions it again at the 1 hour, 7 minute mark. And so we're going to just listen to what he said about it here to get started.
I don't think verbatim identicality of wording is sufficient to do it. And I brought this out in that Detroit paper. There are places where there's actually a contradiction, a formal contradiction between different TR editions. One of my favorite is in James 2, where the one uses the word with and the one uses the word without, and like, show me your faith by your works and show me your faith without your works. I mean, that's if you zoom in that tightly, that is a contradiction. How could they possibly both be preserved by God? Now, actually, I prefer to zoom out further and say, well, if you look at the whole verse, the whole argument, it's the same argument. But how come that principle, like, he's allowed to choose the zoom level, but I'm not? I don't think I cannot find that viewpoint compelling for that reason.
Yeah. And I will say, I think Ross spoke.
So I tried to explain in the third video that my sister principle to verbatim identicality is substantive doctrinal equivalence, or verbal equivalence, not dynamic equivalence, but verbal equivalence, substantive doctrinal equivalence. Okay. So the variant there, and I said there are two different types of variants. There's a different way of saying the same thing and a substantive difference in meaning. Now, what Brother Ward just said there is that he chooses, that he views and understands the variant there to be just a different way of saying the same thing. That's the way I would characterize that. Now, because Brother Ward has brought up the Detroit Baptist Seminary Journal article here, I would like to sort of look at this article in the framework of this conversation. And again, the reason I'm doing this is because Brother Ward brought this up in his critique of me. Now, let me just give you just a brief history. When I first began speaking with Brother Ward in late spring, early summer of 2021, he sent me this journal article here that is on the screen, okay? Which Texas Receptus, or Critique of Confessional Bibliology by Mark Ward. I read it before I talked to him the first time. And when I read it, my big takeaway was, well, if you drop verbatim identicality of wording and you adopt my sister principles of not requiring verbatim identicality of wording, but substantive doctrinal equivalence, then basically majority of the things that are brought out in this paper go away as far as being problems. Okay. Now, to be fair, Brother Ward is critiquing confessional bibliology, okay? And so we just kind of need to keep that in mind. But he does say some things in the paper that, as I've investigated it more deeply since the release of their video on July 20, that I think need to sort of be addressed. The first thing that I would like to address starts on page 65 of the article. And up to this point, Brother Ward's kind of given some history, gone through some background information, and now he's getting ready to sort of enter into the crux or the meat of what the article is about. Okay, now notice what he says here. This paper will not look at typographical errors, but at various lections, that's a word for variance, between two TR editions. And this paper is driving at a point. TR editions feature the same kind of variance as those that occur between the critical text and the Textus Receptus. The two viewpoints differ only in degree and not in kind. Okay. So he's admitting that there's a difference in degree between these two texts. Now, remember in his critique of me, he said all Bibles are essentially saying the same thing. So he's acknowledging at least that there's a difference in degree between the Textus Receptus and the critical text. Then the next paragraph, he says, we will examine all the kinds of differences between two of the 28 editions of the TR, probably the most significant editions in existence. Number one, Stephanus's 1550 TR, which was the most widely used Greek New Testament in England during the time of the King James translators. So there's a supposition made there that the most widely used Greek New Testament at the time of the translation was the 1550 Stephanus. Okay. And I want you to notice here that there is no citation to back up that statement. There is no there's no evidence, there's no citation to back up that claim. Okay, let's see it again. The Stephanus's 1550 TR, which was the most widely used Greek New Testament in England during the time of the King James Version translators, and two, Scrivener's TR, the most widely used TR today. So this statement about Stephanus's 1550 being the most widely used TR during the time of the King James translators has no supporting documentation or evidence to substantiate that. Okay. So the suggestion, therefore, is that that the King James translators relied heavily on Stephanus, and that's what they used when making their translation. And yet there's nothing there to back that up. Okay. Now, the reason I have a problem with that is because of works like this, The Reformed Roots of the English New Testament, The Influence of Theodore Beza on the English New Testament by Arena Backus. Arena Backus proves conclusively in this monograph that the most widely used edition of the King James translators was the 1598 fourth edition of Theodore Beza. That Beza's latest edition, 1598 fourth edition, was viewed by the translators as the most authoritative edition. Yet we have Brother Ward making a statement here that it's the 1550 Stephanus that was the most widely used during the time of the King James translators without evidence, without citation or documentation. So I kind of have a problem with that. Now watch, by comparing these two TRs, we will see where the King James translators decided against the most significant TR of their day. Now I have to say, I view this as, I think Brother Ward is sort of, in his answer to confessional bibliology, he's sort of creating a straw man. He has said without evidence or documentation that it's the 1550 Stephanus that was the most widely used. And now he's endeavoring in the next sentence by comparing these two TRs, Scrivener 1881 and Stephanus 1550, we will see where the King James translators decided against the most significant TR edition of their day. Notice that nothing is said about Beza here. We will see then that where the King James translators did the work of textual criticism on their main TR. So it is very clear that Brother Ward is asserting that the 1550 Stephanus was the main TR, the most popular TR, and the one that was used by the King James translators when they went about their edition. Okay, now listen, those aren't my claims, those are Brother Ward's. And they're being made here without any supporting evidence, documentations, or citations. So in my opinion, as Brother Ward now goes out to answer confessional bibliology, he is creating a bit of a straw man argument here by saying 1550 Stephanus was the most significant. We're going to look at how the King James translators decided against the most significant. He says nothing about Beza's edition from 1598 as he sets up this argument. Okay. So then he talks about spelling differences. He talks about differences that do not have to show up in translation, but could. Differences in word order that do not affect meaning. Differences that amount to simple redundancies. Differences in number, singular versus plural. Okay. He admits here that from that perspective, they're trifling. So he acknowledges that a lot of these differences are nothing. Differences of persons in pronouns. Tense and or mood differences in verbs. Okay. Now, as I went through my analysis based upon my two things, to me, none of these spelling differences, differences that do not have to show up in translation, differences in word order that do not affect meaning, differences that amount to simple redundancies and differences in order, none of these are substantive. Differences in personal pronouns. So in other words, none of these create substantive differences in understanding. Okay. In the interlude, he says here in italics, he says, by dismissing all differences among TRs as minor, they have they have implicitly agreed to dismiss a huge portion of the differences between the TRs and the critical text. Okay. Now listen, no one is disputing the fact that in large portions of the text, the TR and the critical text are essentially the same. No one's disputing this. It is in the matters where they differ that the dispute comes in. No one is arguing that there are swaths of the text that are essentially the same. No one's arguing this. So I'm not sure that I'm following this. So then we need to come down to differences that produce meaning. Okay, and this is where things get a little bit more interesting. All right, now what Brother Ward does is he has he's going to now talk about a different category or kind of difference. He says many TR defenders will likely feel comfortable dismissing as insignificant the kinds of variances in the seven categories that preceded the interlude. So that's what we just went through very, very quickly there. Most differences between the TRs in this paper are simply and obviously not significant, but there are a few which are more significant to label minor, though the TBS does. That's Trinitarian Bible Society. There are places where Stephanus and Scrivener use wholly different words requiring noticeably different translations. Some principle of evaluative judgment must be brought for each. So again, remember we're comparing here Scrivener with Stephanus, all right? Now, in this section, okay, in this section, Brother Ward is going to talk about 10 passages, all right? Matthew 2:11, 1 Peter 1:8, 1 Timothy 1:4, 1 John 1:5, 2 Corinthians 11:10, 2 Thessalonians 2:4, Philemon 1:7, Hebrews 9:1, James 5:12, and Revelation 7:10, okay? So Stephanus's 1550 edition contains the variant readings in the margin found in Scrivener cited by Ward in James 5:12 and Revelation 7:10, yet Ward fails to mention this fact, okay? Now, so what I'm saying here is, now remember, he's pitting Stephanus against Scrivener, okay? Yet when we look at least two of the 10, we can see very plainly in the case of James 5:12 that the variant reading is in the Scrivener text. So it's in the Stephanus text from 1550. So the reading that shows up later in Scrivener is in marginally in the Stephanus 1550 text, yet that is not discussed. The same is true in Revelation 7:10. Okay. And in addition, five of the passages noted by Ward in this section have attestation in Beza's 1598. These include 1 Timothy 1:4, 2 Corinthians 11:10, Hebrews 9:1, James 5:12, and Revelation 7:10. Once again, we ask the question, why are these textual variants not cited by Ward? Why is Ward pitting Scrivener against Stephanus against Scrivener? So of these, let's see, we got one, two, three, half of the passages that are in this section of differences in meaning as Stephanus is pitted against Scrivener, half of these passages have already been resolved in the TR tradition by 1598, Beza's fourth edition, when the King James translators set about to do their work. So the King James translators, in adopting these readings, they are not choosing Stephanus. They're not breaking from Stephanus. Two of them have two of the Stephanus texts have the marginal, the reading. They're going with Beza, who had already settled some of these issues or smoothed out some of these difficulties. Okay, but Ward is pitting Stephanus against Scrivener. He's completely glossing over Beza, who was the preeminent edition at the time of the King James translators. So in five of the 10 examples, Beza had already settled on this. So why do we see a pitting of Stephanus against Scrivener when Beza has already settled the matter and the King James translators have followed Beza? Then in the next thing is we have missing clauses, okay? Let's see here. We have a discussion of missing clauses on page 73. And the text that's going to take center stage in this discussion is 1 John chapter 2, verse 23, where, as we can see here, the 1611 has in Roman font, what would now be italics in our day, they have the last clause, the second half of the verse, in the equivalent of italics. Okay. Now, we need to note a different way of saying the same thing between a substantive difference in meaning. Now, in the case of this example, we need to note again that Stephanus, the 1550 Stephanus, has the marginal reading. It has the clause in question, okay? So none of this is mentioned, though, when it's discussed. So in his journal article, Ward pits the 1550 edition of the TR, edited by Stephanus, against the 1881 edition of Scrivener for 1 John chapter 2, verse 23. In doing so, Ward implies that the King James translators acted without Greek support with his statement, quote, "They did this apparently to indicate textual doubtfulness. Indeed, again, the entire clause is missing from Stephanus." Okay, now let's just stop there. All right, it's not in the text, but it's in the margin. That's not mentioned. The clause in question is in the margin of Stephanus. All right. But notice this language here. "They did this apparently to indicate textual doubtfulness." Okay. "Indeed, again, the entire clause is missing from Stephanus." Italics, or in the case of the 1611 edition Roman font, were not used by the translators to indicate textual doubtfulness, but little or no support in the Greek text. So Ward is saying that the reason this is in italics is because they doubted the text. That's not why the King James translators use Roman type or italics. Italics, or in the case of the 1611 Roman font, were not used by the translators to indicate textual doubtfulness, but little or no support in the Greek text. The fact that they put it in the text is an indication that they believed it to be authentic, but they were honest about the issue of support in the Greek. Ward is asserting that the translators put words and clauses into their text that they, quote, doubted were authentic. While this is true of modern translations, example, which include the Pericope Adultery and Mark 16, 9-20, this was not true of the King James translators. Yet as the image above captures, Stephanus had the Greek clause in question at 1 John chapter 2, verse 23, in the margin of his 1550 edition. Moreover, Beza's fourth edition of the TR from 1598 contains the clause in the text of 1 John chapter 2, verse 23, as the following images bear out. So here's Beza's edition. Here's 1 John chapter 2, 1 John chapter 2, verse 23. The clause is in the main Greek text, which was the preeminent edition of the TR when the King James translators did their work. Here we see the annotation underneath that explaining this, and here's a brief English translation, okay, of this. "The passage is restored in Greek from the authority of four manuscripts, the Old Latin, the Syriac translation." And so Beza puts it into the text. Stephanus had it in the margin. Beza put it into the main text. And so it's what I'm saying, it's like I was questioned in this video that I'm critiquing right now. I was questioned for being convoluted, for things being a shame and folly unto me when I go outside of my wheelhouse, when I talk about things, you know, that are outside of history. And I'm just wanting to say, like, it's amazing to me that those kinds of things were said. And when we look at and evaluate this Detroit Baptist Seminary Journal article, I see a lot of things here that I'm scratching my head and I'm saying, you're criticizing me, yet you're not necessarily being forthcoming with all of the information. So, like, I get your critiquing confessional bibliology, but why are these textual facts that bear heavily on your case not being brought out and discussed? Okay. Ward misrepresented the 1550 Stephanus by stating, quote, "the entire clause is missing from Stephanus" when the reading is found in the margin. That is never discussed. He then ignored Beza's 1598 edition so that he could pit Stephanus against Scrivener. The goal here is to argue that the same, quote, category of differences exists between the TRs and critical texts too. Next, Ward leverages the inclusion of 1 John 5, 7, and 8 in Scrivener's TR with its inclusion, with its exclusion from the Nestle on 28, to argue that the same kind of omission is seen in 1 John 2:23 when one compares the TR editions of Stephanus and Scrivener. But as the facts presented in this document bear out, Ward is not making an apples-to-apples comparison, given the fact that Stephanus included the clause in the margin of his 1550 edition, a fact that Ward omits from his discussion. Therefore, Ward's hypothetical statement, quote, if omission equals denial, it does not, then the critical text is doctrinally faulty at 1 John 5, 7, and 8, but Stephanus's TR is then doctrinally faulty at 1 John chapter 2, verse 23. Has no purchase as a statement of fact in the debate. So, like, we're not making an apples-to-apples comparison here, is my point. Ward is trying to get two TRs to disagree with each other so that he can advance the supposition that the same kind of differences that exist between editions of the TR exist between the TR and the critical text. Ward argues in this fashion to assert that choosing the critical text over the TR is the same as simply choosing which TR. He wants to say, yep, if you're choosing TRs, it's the same thing as if you're choosing the critical text or the TR. Because none of these are substantive, is essentially what's being said. The ultimate goal in Ward's line of argumentation is to minimize the differences between the TR and the critical text to one kind or type of differences, i.e. missing sections. So what he's saying is the same types of things exist between TR editions, where he stacks Stephanus against Scrivener, that exist between the TR and the critical text. Okay? The ultimate goal in Ward's line of argumentation is to minimize the differences between the TR and the critical text to one kind of or type of difference, missing sections, as in the case of the long ending of Mark 16, 9 through 20, and the woman taken in adultery. Regarding these missing sections, Ward concludes the following on page 74. Okay, on page 74, he concludes the following. He says, for the purposes of this article and this argument, however, it must be acknowledged that John 7:53 through 8:11, the woman taken in adultery, and Mark 16:9 through 20, now watch, make up the lone serious substantive kind of difference that exists between the two textual traditions. Now, it's interesting to me that he uses the word substantive, because my sister principles in my answer to these brethren on the issue of verbatim identicality are preservation does not require verbatim identicality. It requires substantive doctrinal equivalence. And it turns out that Brother Ward is acknowledging that whether or not one includes or excludes these two main textual variants, it is substantive. It's a substantive kind of difference that exists between the two textual traditions. So how then can the assertion be made in the video critiquing me that all the Bibles are saying the same thing? Because whether you include just these two texts alone, these two variants alone, or exclude, is substantive, and Brother Ward is admitting it here in his journal article when it comes to confessional bibliology. And here we can see the statement on page 74, just so that you can see that I am not making it up or misquoting. It is right here. For the purposes of this article and this argument, however, it must be acknowledged that John 7:53 through 8:11 and Mark 16:9 through 20 make up the lone serious substantive kind of difference that exists between the two textual traditions. So there is an admission there that there are substantive textual variants between the TR and the critical text, which is the entire point. The entire point of the difference between TR, King James Advocates, and critical text, Modern Version Advocates, is not the amount of similarities between the texts, but the differences between the texts that are substantive, that substantively alter the doctrinal content of the Bible depending on how you deal with the variant. Okay? A principle that they admitted in their video critique of me. And again, the statement being, let me find it so that I'm not accused of misrepresenting, Variants change the meaning of a particular text at the micro level, but not at the macro level. Okay. So therefore, Ward seems to be admitting, despite his claim to the contrary in his video critique of me, that there are substantive differences of meaning between the TR and the critical text, depending on how one settles the variants presented by these missing passages. And I would just add, this is just two. We're not even getting into yet whether or not without a cause should be in the book of Matthew, or the other 20 verses that are missing from the critical text when compared to the TR. Okay. So like, if it applies in two of these, then what about all the other ones that aren't even being discussed, where whole verses are either in or not in the text? How are those also not substantive when there seems to be admission here that two of the big three are? Okay. And then we could get into the contradictions section. And this is where Brother Ward brings up the James 2:18 passage from the video that we just looked at. Okay. We just heard him say in this video, his video critique of me, talking about the Zoom level related to verbatim identicality, and how in James 2:18, there's a formal contradiction between TRs. So let's look at that. That piece right there in that statement was what led me into a wider dissection of the Detroit Baptist Seminary Journal article that I have shared in this video, okay? So, where are we at here? So, first of all, I just want to mention that Erasmus in his 1516 first edition notes an annotation at James 2:18. Okay, he is aware of the difference between by works and without works as early as 1516 in the TR tradition. It is noted in a footnote. But then notice again, we have the Stephanus. Remember that Ward is pitting the 1550 Stephanus in his journal article against the 1881 Scrivener. And notice again, we have the variant reading in the margin of Stephanus at James 2:18. Okay. So the TR edition of Stephanus 1550 that Ward is referencing in his article and pitting against Scriveners from 1881 contains the variant reading in the margin at James 2:18. Why is this not mentioned in the journal article? Okay. And then we have the 1598 Beeson footnote here for James chapter 2:18, okay? And Beza is acknowledging the existence of the footnote. So the only known TR edition that has the King James reading in the text pre-Beza's fourth edition from 1598, Beza changed it in his 1582, and it seems his following editions all kept the reading. So again, we have a case where Ward is pitting Stephanus from 1550 against Scrivener. Stephanus has the marginal reading he has the alternative reading or the variant noted in the margin. That's not mentioned. By the time we get to Beza, the marginal reading has been settled and moved to the main body of the text that the King James translators are using, okay? And it's also in an earlier edition of the TR from 1538 by Colius. Colaninus, I'm not sure the pronunciation there, as Beza mentioned in his note, okay? So the variant was noted by Erasmus in his annotations from 1560. Erasmus noted the variant in the Vulgate, not in the Greek manuscripts, and supplied in the margin by Stephanus in 1550. Beza has a note in his first folio edition, but did not translate the reading into the main body of his text. Therefore, the variant was well known and cataloged by various TR editions since its inception, but with Erasmus in 1560. King James advocate David Cloud has an article online from 2016 titled, "Which Edition of the Received Text Should We Use?" that states the following about the TR readings at James 2:18. Quote, James 2:18, "The last three editions of Beza have without thy works, while Erasmus, Stephanus, and the first edition of Beza have by thy works." Like we just cataloged. The King James Bible Textual Technology website has an article titled "Received Text Inerrancy, Exact Equivalence of Literally Preserves It and Textual Evidence Reveals It," that addresses the TR variants for James 2:18. Okay, here we go. James 2:18, the King James Version, Yea, a man may say, thou hast faith, and I have works. Show me thy faith without thy works, and I will show thee my faith by thy works. Some editions have by in lieu of without. The theme is true faith that produces works. One man may emphasize faith and another works, but the two are never to be separated. The text speaker says, in effect, show me thy faith without thy works, and I'll show you a dead faith, or show me thy faith by thy works, no actual faith, and I'll show you my faith by my works produced by actual faith. Thus, the sense of the verse is teaching the same, whether by or without is utilized. Okay, now, Brother Ward said the same thing about that in the video, okay? And he says here on page 75 of the journal article, the overall point is the same. So whichever variant you want to go with, the overall point of the verse is the same. In other words, it's non-substantive. It doesn't substantively alter the main teaching of the verse, whether you go by or without, because the same force of argument is still in place, whichever one of the variants you want to use, okay? So Ward says the overall point is the same. Works must accompany faith, or it is not true faith. But the rhetorical strategy is markedly different. James is either directly contradicting his imagined interlocutor, as in Stephanus, which, by the way, has the other one in the margin, or subtly, perhaps even sarcastically, challenging his non sequitur, as in Scrivener. As with the examples in the previous category of choice must be made by any translator of the Textus Receptus. But again, the issue was settled by Beza's fourth edition from 1598 that the King James translators were using. Okay? And it was adopted, it was smoothed over in the TR tradition well before the King James translators went about making their translation. And that's not discussed. All right? But again, so here we have a variant. How you settle the variant does not create a substantive difference in meaning by the observation of the gentleman that wrote this website, as well as by Mark Ward. So there is my level of Zoom. When you encounter, you can have variants. You do not need verbatim identicality of wording, but you need substantive doctrinal equivalence. You need verbal equivalence. And however you decide this reading, by Ward's own admission, does not substantively alter the passage. However, but if you exclude the woman taken in adultery or the long ending of Mark, there are substantive kinds of difference between the critical text and the TR there, which would then mean there are substantive differences in translations that are translating those texts and calling them into question. So here we have James 2:18 and the 16:11, and you can see the marginal note here. Some have by. Okay, so they're doing this. The 1611 follows Beza's 1598 text by reading without thy works, while noting the variant reading by thy works in the margin. In terms of some other Reformation-era Protestant Bibles, the 1607 Italian, 1569, 1602 Spanish, the 1588 French all agree with the King James. The 1638 Dutch does not, but does have the King James reading in the footnote. Okay. So we could do some analysis here of this, okay? So again, here we see, here's the 1550 Stephanus that Ward is pitting against Scrivener, and there's the marginal note, but that's not mentioned. Stephanus's 1550 capitalized the first words of James 2:18, while Ward does not in his journal article. To me, that's just noting a fact there. Once again, Ward says nothing about the marginal note cataloging the variant in the text of Stephanus while pitting Stephanus against Scrivener. The same phenomenon can be observed in Ward's analysis of Revelation 11:2, which is the next verse in this category here of contradictions that he's discussing in the journal article. The same phenomenon can be observed in Ward's analysis of Revelation 11:2. Ward pits Stephanus against Scrivener while failing to mention that Stephanus recorded the variant in question in the margin. Furthermore, Beza's 1598 edition contains the same reading as the King James and Scrivener's 1881 edition. Moreover, in the case of Revelation 11:2, Ward is trifling over a difference of spelling of one letter, while at the same time suggesting that the critical text with its host of missing verses is saying the same thing as the TR. This this is what gets me. Like, we're going to talk about one letter, which arguably could be a typo. Okay. It could be a typo, depending on how you want to look at that. And we're going to say, here's a contradiction based on one letter spelling difference in one word. But we're going to say all of the differences, all of the major differences between the TR and the critical text, those don't matter. That is what I cannot swallow in this debate, in this discussion, this greater conversation. One, you cannot make a big deal about one word in a variant, one letter in a variant, which is in the margin of a text that you're not talking about it being there, while you're pitting one against the other, and yet say none of these, you know, all the missing verses between the TR and the critical text, those don't substantively matter because all the Bibles are saying the same thing. I'm sorry, that you can focus on the, you can focus on how in many sections of the New Testament there are no differences, but that's not the point. The point isn't the similarities. The point is, what do you do when they're different? Which one is correct? And yes, they are substantive, as the brothers in the video admit, that how you rectify a variant does impact meaning at the micro level, but not at the macro level. So War pits Stephanus against Scribner, while failed to mention that Stephanus recorded the variant in question in the margin. Furthermore, Beza's 1598 contains the same reading as the King James and Scribner. So here's my other thing with this journal article. Like, why are we not comparing? So let's recap. So the statement was made that the 1550 Stephanus was the most important edition and the one that the King James translators used without foundation, without citation, without a single footnote documenting that that's even a true statement, okay? And so then we go through the article and we have Stephanus pitted against Scribner. Why is Scribner not pitted against Beza, which was the text the King James translators relied upon as they went about revising the bishop's Bible? Why is Beza not mentioned, and why is the focus on Scribner? The reason it's not Beza, in my opinion, is if you compare Scribner with Beza, they're essentially the same. There's 190 times that Scribner says that the King James translators departed from Beza. Most of those are related to spelling and significant and non-significant or inconsequential things. And there are maybe, by my understanding, 20 where they went with a different reading other than Beza. So, like, there's some deck stacking here, in my opinion, in this argumentation. Furthermore, Beza's 1598 edition contains the same reading. Okay, we already read that twice. Moreover, in the case of Revelation 11:2, he's trifling over different spelling of words. Already talked about that, yet suggesting the TR, which is host of missing verses, is saying the same thing as the TR, the CT, that is. Missing verses, saying the same thing as a TR, while talking about spelling differences of one letter. Lastly, Ward cites John 7:8, see below for the information, as an example of the same category of difference between the TR and the CT. The CT's omission of yet in John 7:8 results in Jesus contradicting himself out of his own mouth when two verses later in John 7:10, he goes to the feast. This is a textual difference of profound significance. At stake is whether Jesus lied. These variants cannot be said to be saying the same thing. And even when you zoom out to the macro level per ward, it results in a difference between a sinless and sinful Savior. Yet Brother Ward maintains that all Bibles are saying the same thing. This is where, like, obviously there's not verbatim identicality, obviously, but obviously how you settle these is going to affect doctrine. I don't see it. And like I said in my third video, we went through four historical examples of response to the revised version when it was released. They knew it. George Van Smith, a Unitarian that worked on the translation committee, he knew it. They all knew that it was impacting doctrine. Okay. So here we have John 7:8. Here's Biza. And you can see the documentation and a translation here of the footnote. It's long. I'm not going to get into all of it. But you can see, folks, Biza was the text. Here's my lesson 181 from my From This Generation Forever class, where I was going through the notes of John Boyce. As part of my due diligence and preparation for these lessons, I prepared a list of all extra-biblical references in Boyce's notes. I do not claim that this list is complete or exact, as some of the material is a bit hard to make out sometimes. Some of the names are abbreviations. Some of the names are abbreviations for the names of the full authors. Moreover, Boyce utilized many older spellings. The following table is a presentation of my findings. So in Boyce's notes that he took at the general meeting on the final sort of stage of the process of translating the King James Bible, he takes notes, and Biza is mentioned 12 times. He is the second highest mention of an extra-biblical writer in the notes of John Boyce is Theodore Biza. Okay? Again, why would that be? Because Biza is the one that Biza's edition is the one that the King James translators are using and relying on as they are revising the Bishop's Bible per rule number one, the influence of Theodore Biza. There is a whole section in Irina Backus's monograph here, The Reformed Roots of the English New Testament, The Influence of Theodore Biza on the English New Testament, that documents very clearly that Biza had the highest influence on the King James translators as they set about doing their work. So where we get this idea from now that we're going to pit Stephanus, who is unsubstantiatedly claimed to be the most popular one that the King James translators used, should probably read that statement again. Just give me a moment to find it here in my notes. Here it is. It's this statement right here. Stephanus' 1550 TR, which was the most widely used Greek New Testament in England during the time of the King James translators, okay? And he says that they're going to compare those two TRs, and we'll see where the King James translators decided against the most significant TR of their day. Folks, I would submit to you that that is not a factually accurate statement, and I would submit to you that that Irina Backus proves this in her monograph here about the influence of Theodore Biza. Boyce never mentioned Stephanus once in his notes from the general meeting. Okay, and we can go through, I'm not going to read all this. I'll leave a link to these notes in the description for this video. But in my estimation, in my analysis, Backus's monograph offers strong evidence that Biza's Greek New Testament served as the primary original language source for the revision of the 1602 Bishop's Bible and one to ultimately become the King James Bible New Testament. The notes of John Boyce highlight the immense influence of Biza upon the King James translators. I propose that the sources used to create the King James Bible were as follows. Rule 1, the 1602 Bishop's Bible was compared against Biza's 1598 Greek New Testament, which was compared against earlier English Bibles, which was compared against foreign language Bibles, which was compared against extra-biblical language resources. Now, you could have Erasmus and other things that they no doubt looked at here, but the primary tool that is used in the translation of the King James New Testament in the revision of the 1602 bishops into what would become the King James is the 1598 fourth edition of the Greek New Testament of Biza, not the 1550 Stephanus. The most up-to-date research at the time would have been available by Biza, not through Stephanus. So we can look at all this and we could say, what is going on here? Because Ward is admitting that there are TR, that between the CT and the TR, critical text of Textus Receptus, there's at least two that are substantive. He says that. My two principles are verbatim. You don't need to have verbatim identicality of wording, but you need to have substantive doctrinal equivalence. These are the main issues. Okay? These are the main issues, and so I just have to say, as I wind this down, I was accused of, you know, being obtruse, being convoluted, you know, things were a folly and a shame unto me when I, you know, strayed from the path of history. At one point I was claimed to not have a backbone and that I needed to have a backbone to stand up against, you know, King James onlyist, et cetera. So like a lot of things were said behind the veneer of a lot of compliments that if you really think about it, were quite biting. And all I'm going to say is in this journal article here, there are a lot of things that are said that I believe are not substantiated, that are pitting things against each other so that there can be a point made. And the point that is being made, not only do I feel in a sort of tacit admission, does affirm my principle of substantive doctrinal equivalence. Because Brother Ward directly says that in the TR critical text debate, there are at least two substantive kinds: the woman taken in adultery and the long ending of Mark. While at the same time, in the video critique of me saying all the Bibles are saying the same thing. So my point in making this video was to dissect the article from the vantage point and the framework of how it was, my work was critiqued. And I'm saying that I think there are significant critiques that could be leveled against the reasoning that these men have and the reasoning presented by Brother Ward in his journal article. And so it's never substantiated why Stephanus was the one they used when it was Beza. And there are things withheld about this, textual facts withheld, that I feel that I question. I say, why is that happening? And I think the reason that it's happening is because of the what is going on here is an emphasis on the similarities between the TR and the critical text, and not the differences. All the difference in the world in this larger discussion debate about text and translation is because of the differences. What is going on when they differ? The idea that they're all saying the same thing is not tenable, and I would argue is admitted on some level by Brother Ward in his essay on the woman taken in adultery in Mark 16. And if those are substantive, then why aren't other omissions substantive? In my opinion, my principles, verbatim identicality, substantive doctrinal equivalence, are the best explanation of the facts as they exist. If you want to know more information about that, you need to check out my book, From This Generation Forever, Volume 2 on Preservation. Please consider picking up a copy of that and reading my thoughts on that. I guess I don't really have too much more to say in this particular video, other than, again, to just encourage you, if you've never trusted Jesus Christ, if you have never relied exclusively in his shed blood for you on the cross, his burial, his resurrection as the only total complete payment for your sin, trust Jesus Christ today. God loves you. Christ died for your sin. He sent his son to die for your sin, to satisfy the offended justice of God against your sin, so that when you, by faith, reach out to a Redeemer who paid the price, who did what was necessary in your stead and in your place, he could give you eternal life as a free gift. Trust Jesus Christ today before it's everlasting too late. Thanks for your attention, and we'll see you next time.